Lecture 5, Etruscan Burial and Mourning.
How people are mourned and the ways in which bodies are prepared for final deposition are among the most conservative and characteristic components of culture. For that reason, such mourning and burial rites can remain as evidence of a culture's practices long after other cultural markers have been eliminated by change or by cultural dominance from the outside. These rites generally change only very slowly and only in reaction to enormous pressures, usually ones that threaten the culture or society in existential ways. Now, a modern parallel is, I think, the Catholic Church's approach to cremation, which shows the slow pace of change. Catholics were forbidden to practice cremation until 1963 because of a doctrine known as the resurrection of the body, which pledged that Jesus, upon his return to earth, would restore the bodies and lives of the dead. Even when the church did finally make allowances for cremation, it was not until 1997 that cremated remains were allowed at funeral masses. And even today, more than 50 years after the prohibition was lifted, only a very small minority of Catholics elects to be cremated. So funeral practices are meaningful, revealing a great deal about culture, and they change slowly. Each of these principles applies to our study of Etruscan funerals and burials, which tell us much not only about funeral practice itself, but also about cultural beliefs and priorities. For instance, in the Etruscan funeral tradition, each burial seems designed to preserve and celebrate the identity and social status of the deceased, and in some cases, signify the deceased's primary relationships, such as marriage. In all extant examples, Etruscan funerals were celebrated with imagery, sometimes supplemented with inscriptions and status accessories, which I mean things that projected or conveyed the status of the deceased from this life. The desire to project individual identity was expressed through spaces and materials developed in a number of surprising ways. For example, cinerary urns, that is, the urns which contained the ashes of a cremation, that have survived over the centuries, have lids that reflect status and gender. In some instances, bronze helmets cap the round urns of men, indicating the male gender and warrior status of the deceased. This desire to celebrate the individual seems also to have been a key instigator in the development of Etruscan portraiture, which is linked to their burial practices, a tradition we see later in Roman art, where portraits are a prominent part of tombs and memorials. But it will be helpful, I think, to examine this material in order, from death until burial and beyond. And that's because many Etruscan tombs were used by extended families, as attested to by the multiple burials and crowded urns found in some of them. So family members were laid out with the assumption that their remains and grave goods, that is, the items that were laid in the grave with the deceased, would be seen again later in the future as other family members were laid to rest in these extended family, multi-generational tombs. By this means, a family could repeatedly demonstrate its piety through funerary rituals and lavish tombs. Now, we'll look at a range of tomb types in a bit. Funerary rituals, which we'll examine first, have a number of key common elements. The deceased lying in state, a funeral procession, funerary games, dances, sacrifices, ritual meals, and the deposition of the deceased. Now, I have to say, no written descriptions of such practices survive, but based on a few tomb paintings from the Etruscan necropolis, or city of the dead of Tarquinia, it's clear that the Etruscans practiced what in Greek is called prothesis, or lying in state. And I say in state as opposed to just viewing is because Elite Etruscan men had a public identity, and women too, and so it truly was a public ceremony. This, prothesis, is the rite by which the deceased was laid out at home for mourners to visit over a set number of days. Now, the Tarquinia paintings show bodies laid on couches, anointed with oils, and covered with garlands, that is, flower garlands. The design of Etruscan tombs to resemble the house of the deceased also seems to connect the original lying in state of the dead with their final deposition in the eternal home, the tomb. A funeral procession then provided the linkage between the home and tomb. These processions typically included the deceased, his or her family, grave goods, animals to sacrifice, and mourners, all walking to that extramural necropolis, that is, city of the dead, outside the walls of the city of the living. And that's where the remainder of the funerary rituals would take place. Now, the best evidence for the procession, as it is for the rite of the prothesis, is another tomb painting from Tarquinia. The Tomb of the Typhon from the 2nd century BC preserves a wall painting showing a procession of 16 figures, presumably the deceased, relatives and retainers, along with demons, replete with many of their standard sort of demonic attributes, snakes, torches, and hammers. The figures in the painting are all lined up in rows to lend a perspective of space as the back rows rise up the wall. Their faces are individualized, and the artist or artists used a range of frontal, profile, and three-quarter views to add variety and a sense of depth to the composition. The painting of the procession could depict the spiritual journey of the deceased, dressed as, and with the attributes of a magistrate, to the underworld, accompanied by demons, family, priests, and retainers, their numbers and variety reinforcing the status the deceased enjoyed in life. That combination of the natural and supernatural is found throughout Italic and later Roman art. Rather than detracting from the historicity of an occasion, it served to highlight the significance of an event with the divine in attendance. However, the inclusion of the family and other supporters in the painting could lead to the alternative conclusion that this might be a different sort of procession. In this alternative view, the procession could be a rite of the funeral itself, leading to the tomb rather than a metaphoric journey to the underworld. The priests, who have come along to help conduct the ceremony, may themselves be dressed as demons and infernal figures, signifying their role easing the passage of the deceased. Prior to a battle between the Romans and the Etruscans from Tarquinia in 356 BC, the Roman historian Livy records the occurrence of precisely this sort of pageantry. He writes in Book 7 of his history that the Romans were thrown into a panic because leading the Etruscan troops came priests bearing serpents and blazing torches before them, which utterly dismayed the Roman soldiers with the extraordinary sight. Note that the attributes Livy describes are the same as those in the wall painting, and that is, those of the demons of the underworld. The idea here for this battle is the priests are out there ready to convey the spirits of all the dead Romans into the underworld. It's another way of saying, you're going to die. So that use of these same attributes blurs the lines between historic event and symbolic representation. Now, the painting itself represents a couple of, important cultural moments. First, it bears witness, along with Livy's account, to the rise of the imagery of death and demons that we see in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. As the Etruscans lost battle after battle, they were literally fighting for their existence, and a darker, pessimistic tone comes to permeate their art. Many more scenes of violence, sadness, and demons are found, especially in their tomb art. Now, I think it's notable that no historical scenes were painted on Etruscan tombs until their wars with Rome. the rise of purely military imagery in male burials, as seen in the Tomb of the Reliefs from about 300 BC from the city of Cerveteri, with multiple relief images of weapons and armor carved on its walls, goes along with these. Scholars continue to debate the origins of the habit of historical commemoration, whether they're from Rome or from Etruria. But one thing is clear. By the 3rd century BC, historical paintings were found in the tombs of Etruscans, Romans, and Lucanians from southern Italy. Now, the most spectacular and among the most commonly illustrated parts of the funeral were the games held in honor of the deceased. These games were sponsored by the surviving family, which had a vested interest in creating lavish events that would reflect well on the deceased and on the survivors. A variety of athletic contests could be held with prizes for the winners. Surviving Etruscan literature doesn't include any descriptions of these comparable to the detailed accounts that we have in, say, of Greek funeral games in Book 23 of Homer's Iliad, or of Roman ones from, say, Book 5 of Virgil's Aeneid. So for confirmation of these Etruscan funeral games, we again turn to tomb paintings, which were created to preserve for future generations these otherwise ephemeral spectacles, as the paintings did for other funeral components. One of these paintings is in the Tomb of the Augurs from about 500 BC at the necropolis at Tarquinia. It provides one of the earliest Etruscan tomb paintings illustrating what becomes a common motif in the medium, funeral games. The interior, large-scale fresco paintings in the tomb take as their subjects the events of funerary ritual. We see mourners flanking a doorway that I and most other scholars think of as the entryway to the tomb, or perhaps, as others think, the door into the underworld. Some figures depicted in the painting are performing religious rituals, because in fact, every part of a funeral was ritual. For example, the augurs who give their name to the tomb are priests shown examining the flights of birds to predict the future. One wall, however, has two sets of figures performing in funeral games. On the right is a man in a costume holding a leash that leads to a collared dog that's attacking a second man who's armed with a club but whose head is covered with a bag. The central pair of figures on the right-hand wall, however, are wrestlers, showing the Etruscan reliance on Greek models for Etruscan art. The figures participating in a Greek athletic contest are also drawn in the Greek style with archaic proportions, notably the thick-set figures of Greek art from the Peloponnesus and southern Italy, and the mix of profile figures but frontal eyes that we see of that period. Between these two wrestlers is a stack of cauldrons, which is a standard Greek prize for athletic events. On the left wall, directly opposite the wrestlers, is a pair of boxers. Perhaps the largest and most Greek of the paintings of funeral athletic competitions is found in the Tomb of the Olympic Games. Once again, archaeologists show their disturbing lack of originality in naming things. But the Tomb of the Olympic Games is from about 525 BC, also from Tarquinia. The paintings that fill the tomb interior show a foot race, discus throwers, the long jump event, boxers, and a chariot race. Each of these events is found in Greek sacred games, such as the Olympics. In addition, there's another image of what appears to be a man fighting a dog, a very non-Greek image, as at the Tomb of the Augurs. Now, the question arises whether these images reflect actual games at the funeral of the Etruscan who's buried here, or if they're a symbolic display representative of the piety of the family in honoring the deceased. I'm sorry, but we can't know for sure. The least understood part of the funeral, and that, my friends, is a competitive category, is the dancing. We don't know if this was dancing by the mourners or a performance for their benefit. A bronze tablet with records of Etruscan rituals, lists among the key rituals for a funeral dance, to dance the tripudium. Now, the term tripudium means literally 3 foot or 3 step. Given the context, it seems to be indicative of the priests dancing, certainly an activity known from, for example, the Roman world, where priests had a host of different dances, including war dances. Now, as tempting as it is with that name, 3-step dance, I don't think we can imagine a waltz, but something perhaps a little more solemn. Images of these Etruscan funerary dances also survive. 2 bronze lids from cinerary urns are covered with small-scale bronze figures who seem to be engaged in a funeral dance. One of these bronze lids shows 8 naked men bearing shields and spears dancing in a circle around an animal, probably soon to be a sacrifice. The other lid has 4 small naked warriors armed with spears and shields dancing in a circle around a pole or a pillar with 4 horse protomes, that is, the heads of horses projecting from it. Once again, Roman practice could confirm the interpretation that these dancers were priests. The Arvile Brethren, an ancient group of Roman priests, so old that it predates the founding of Rome itself, performed a dance in the spring, armed with spear and shield. They are, however, clothed, as far as we can tell. Now, the Etruscan dancing priests may be naked to ward off evil or to emphasize fertility, a metaphorical belief in the life after death of the person about to be placed underground. Like plants, the deceased would rise after being planted. We know also that agricultural fertility ceremonies of the Etruscans frequently featured nudity or sexual activity. And that leads us to the notion of immortality and the critical role of sacrifice in ensuring it. A sacrifice was the central element of the funerary ritual. For the Etruscans, this meant blood sacrifice, perhaps on occasion even human sacrifice. In some instances, spirits were thought to be appeased by blood sacrifice. In others, such as the occasion in Book 11 of the Odyssey, when Odysseus provides blood for the souls in the underworld, they need it. It animates the spirits so they can communicate with the living. The Italian archaeologist Mario Torelli argued that the sacrifices in Etruscan funeral rituals took place on the grassy areas atop the tombs themselves, so that blood would seep down to the dead. The ancient author, Arnobius, reports, "They promise this in the Acherontic books in Etruria, that by blood of certain animals, divine souls become endowed with certain numinous spirits, and they're led away from the laws of mortality." What he means there is that blood sacrifice confers immortality. I'd like to think about an episode of Joss Whedon's old TV show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. In one of the episodes, a vampire explains much the same, only not quite as pompously. He says, "Blood is life. Why do you think we eat it? It's what keeps you going, makes you warm, makes you hard, makes you other than dead." Now, I know my pop culture references aren't just dated, they're carbon dated, but Joss Whedon was following and updating the Etruscan tradition there. The tradition? Now, that blood sacrifice might be an animal, for example, a puppy, as Etruscan ritual texts make clear, or even a human, as the Greek historian Herodotus tells us. He gives us the account that after the naval battle off Ilia, that is, in the Tyrrhenian Sea on the west coast of Italy in 535 BC, the Etruscans, as part of a ritual, stoned to death their Greek captives. Now, while animal blood sacrifice continued in Etruscan culture, human sacrifice seems to diminish, and it was replaced by symbolic human sacrifice. Visual representations are found in tomb paintings, such as those in the Francois tomb from Volchi, that graphically show Achilles, the Greek hero, sacrificing Trojan prisoners at the culmination of the funeral of Patroclus in the Iliad. In the same tomb, we have an Etruscan, Aulae Vipinus, who executes another man. And the most popular subject of all, also in the tomb, the sons of Oedipus, Eteocles and Polynices, commit simultaneous fratricide, that is, on the battlefield, engaging with one another. They kill each other simultaneously with sword thrusts. And we see that on a wall painting in the Francois tomb, along with on scores of later cinerary urns. Now note that the shift from actual to artistic representation carries with it a change from Etruscan tradition to the use of Greek myth, to carry the same meaning and symbolic importance that actual events or portrayal of generic events once did. Dining was also an integral part of funeral rituals. It's the almost invariable next step following sacrifice. I say almost because a banquet doesn't follow human sacrifice. Otherwise, the meat of the sacrificial animal was immediately consumed, generally along with wine. These funerary meals were held at the culmination of the event to honor the dead. They create a formal end to the mourning period and sometimes give the family of the deceased an outlet for generosity, as the dinners might be shared with the wider community. Given that the dead were expected to live again and that they were buried in tombs that were symbolic houses, it stands to reason that they would be buried with the materials they would need to continue their lives in these houses. This means that they were laid out on beds, wearing clothing, jewelry, armor, and personal effects, but also surrounded by household objects. And among these were tremendous amounts of ceramics and bronze objects. Literally tons of these have been found. Now, around 500 BC, a shift occurred as native Etruscan products found in the tombs up to then were replaced by imports. These, I think, reveal a great deal of information, including clues about trade networks. For the vast majority of grave goods from 500 BC on were tons of the extant Greek, especially Athenian, vases. Virtually every intact black or red figure Athenian vase that comes down to us was discovered in an Etruscan tomb. The scale of the trade must have been great and carried on for more than a century. Now, the Etruscans practiced both cremation, that is, the burning of human remains, and inhumation, burial of remains without burning. Cremation was common at Chiusi, once one of the most important. In fact, it is one of the 12 cities of the Etruscan League or Etruscan Federation. While inhumation is found at other communities, such as Cerveteri and Veii, southern communities in Etruria. Both forms of burial utilized vessels for the remains, for cremation urns for ashes, and for inhumation, sarcophagi, or stone coffins. Many cremated remains from the 7th century BC were preserved in bronze or terracotta vessels topped with an anthropomorphic or human-shaped lid. When first excavated, they were called canopic urns because of their resemblance to the Egyptian alabaster vessels with lids carved into the shapes of humans and animals that are used in mummification burials. In Egypt, however, the lids depicted protecting deities, whereas in the Etruscan tradition, the images are exclusively mortal. The individualized face on an Etruscan urn was intended to represent the male whose ashes rested within. Very often, the faces were pierced with holes for the attachment of a mask. These human-headed urns developed by stages. For example, the urn handles become human arms, and the urns themselves, inside of which the ashes were placed, become full statues, leaving no doubt that they provided a very early type of portraiture and were meant to convey an image of the deceased. The urn and its lid, as well as the chair or bed on which the urn rests, are all made separately. In some cases, the chair is bronze, sometimes decorated with elaborate relief work. Now, chairs are a highly symbolic Etruscan image passed down to the Romans. They signify elite male status and might originally have been thrones, or more likely in the later periods, represented the chairs used by magistrates in local government. Here's a tip. If you come into a room where everyone is standing and one person is seated in a high-backed chair with a footstool, pay attention to the seated person. That notion of whether you're seated or standing, I think, is very important. My wife and I went to a party one time at this guy's house, and we're there, and we come in, and there's no chairs. And the host just reaches over and puts his hand on the back of a chair and tips it forward and dumps a young man down on the floor and presents my wife with the chair. It was important that she sit. That idea was used also by the director Sam Raimi in his Western, The Quick and the Dead, where he had the town sheriff, played by Gene Hackman, watching a gunfight while seated as everyone else stood around. It was a great visual. Well, funeral masks were another Etruscan custom, later adopted by the Romans, particularly to transmit the images of elite males through the family. However, the Romans made masks of the dead and then hung them in the atrium of the deceased's home to commemorate their great ancestors, while the Etruscans seem to have made portraits of people in life and then later, after they died, hung them on the urns of the deceased, a pattern that's actually closer to the Egyptian practice. As an early form of portraiture, the mask signifies the priority of this art in conveying the status and rank of the deceased to the family and other spectators of later generations who would enter the tomb. Etruscan terracotta sculpture becomes more artistically and technically sophisticated, and increasingly symbolic as pieces from later centuries show. In the gendered burials, we see clear gender roles. Men get shields and chairs, armor and weapons, and women domestic material. In addition, symbols of the deceased seem to denote their gender. Male burials are marked on the exterior by short pillars and women by stone spheres. On the insides of the tombs, we see further distinctions. Male inhumation burials were marked by semicircular symbols on the headboards above the beds, while female burials were marked by triangular pediments on their beds. Now, I don't understand the meaning of that semicircle which appears at the male burial sites. It might symbolize a symbolic shield, and then again, it might not. However, scholars agree that the triangular pediments signifying females represent the home, that's that pitched roof of the house, and therefore the domestic identities of women. This is surprising because among the Romans and other Latin people, images of the house represent elite male heads of households, never females. This might be another indicator of the relatively elevated status conferred on Etruscan women, whom Greek commentators were amazed to learn actually did things with their husbands. The closeness of men's and women's relationships are also preserved in some tomb art. Perhaps the most celebrated work of Etruscan terracotta sculpture is a sarcophagus for a married couple found in the tomb of the Bondetacea necropolis at Cerveteri, the largest necropolis ever found in the Mediterranean world. It's evidence of the rapid changes in Etruscan art from a small-scale urn about 18 inches tall at Chiusi in about 600 BC to this sarcophagus in about 500 BC, which is large enough for life-size sculptures on its lid. Now, while at first glance the Bondetacea sarcophagus appears to be a work of sculpture in the round, it's really better understood as a very high relief work, with the feet and legs of the male and female couple in shallow relief and the figures from the waist up in very high relief. That emphasis on the upper body and face is an Etruscan convention. Indeed, the portrayal of a couple illustrates Etruscan social customs, with the husband and wife dining together on a banqueting couch, in contrast to the elite Greek practice, which at that time showed two males on a couch, not a man and a woman. The Etruscan figures are very expressive, I think partly due to the use of terracotta, which really allows greater surface detail and more unsupported limbs than marble, for example, would. The artist has paid a great deal of attention to surface detail and pattern, seen in the treatment of the fabric the couple is wearing, as the material wrinkles, drapes, and folds around their bodies. The couple's eyes and hair and the man's beard are also very much surface additions. All of these elements rely on the model of Greek archaic sculpture, from the almond-shaped eyes, pointed chins, and noses, to the shape of the beard and the hair that falls into locks that I refer to as Tootsie Roll hair. It looks like a Tootsie Roll. This is a standard component of contemporary Greek sculpture. As the couple lies together on the couch, the man's right arm reaches across his wife's back and rests on her shoulder. Their hands gesture in a manner that illustrate the Etruscan interest in accurately portraying details of nature. In this instance, how hands move in a variety of ways. The gestures themselves are significant, as the deceased were probably each holding objects related to funerary ritual, such as small perfume flasks, garlands, wine cups, or eggs, all of which are found in funerary imagery. The imagery of couples continues in Etruscan tomb and funerary art for centuries. Eventually, however, the apparent optimism of the smiling archaic figures is replaced by equally apparent pessimism. Whether that reflects the deceased's view of life or the afterlife is unclear, but they are undoubtedly gloomy. My favorite example of this nascent pessimism is found in a tomb of the late 4th century BC from Tarquinia. It shows a married couple, listen to these names, Velther Velka and Rauthu Arithnai. I think this probably tells us one of the great mysteries about the Etruscans, and that is the mystery of why we're not using their names any longer. Anyway, they're reclining on a dining couch. Each rests a hand on the other's near shoulder as if comforting their mate, while the woman in particular has a look of such sadness, if not downright despair, it seems to reflect a tragedy greater than death, a death that should result in rebirth anyway. Well, the apparent equality of man and woman in such depictions is not to infer that men and women were treated identically in life and death. In some tombs, as in the Tomb of the Chairs and Shields and the Tomb of the Reliefs from Cervetere, the men clearly enjoyed privileged positions. This becomes more certain in later tombs from the 3rd century BC on, when social, political, and military upheavals have begun in the Etruscan world. It's possible that the shift from aristocratic to democratic forms of government in the Etruscan world undermined the relative equality practiced by elite men and women in earlier periods. A variety of factors could have contributed to this. First, women are essential in hereditary forms of government, such as monarchies, where dynastic succession is critical and is based on heirs of elite married couples succeeding in the transfer of power. We also can't discount the effect on Etruscan culture of living under siege from the Romans, as the Etruscans found themselves relying on their military more and more to ensure the very survival of their communities. Such conditions likely enhanced the status of those serving as warriors, men, at the expense of the traditional power structure of aristocrats. Therefore, elite women would suffer along with elite men. But in any event, the goal of all such funerary rituals and practices we have explored together here was to demonstrate the piety of the surviving family, who eventually also would make their way from home to tomb, and to ensure the deceased had everything necessary for the afterlife.